Hey, listeners, it's your host, Daisha. You're about to hear or perhaps rehear my interview with Elisa Weilerstein, which was recorded last year-ish. It's about the music of Rachmaninoff, and we're rerunning it because, I mean, let's just be honest, Todd's lazy, so he didn't make a new episode, but mostly because it's Rachmaninoff's birthday! Woo! You will almost definitely enjoy this episode, and if you don't, please see our money-back guarantee FAQs at houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. Also, don't forget to subscribe to, rate us, and review us on iTunes. It only takes a tiny bit of your time, but it means so much to us. Thanks so much, and enjoy the episode. My name is Daisha Clay. I'm the audio librarian here at Classical 91.7. While I'm a real librarian, I have a deep, dark secret. I know very little about classical music. I grew up listening to rock, and I know something about jazz, but when it comes to classical, but I really want to learn. So, every week on this show, a classical music expert will give me a piece of classical music they think I should know, and then we'll discuss it. Come learn with me in the classical classroom. Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Classical Classroom. I'm Daisha Clay, and here with me today is Elisa Weilerstein. She studied at Columbia University and at the Cleveland Institute of Music. She is a champion of new music, and she's dedicated to expanding the cello repertoire. She's also a bona fide genius, a MacArthur Genius Grant Award winner. She's played with orchestras and at music festivals all over the world. And on her latest CD, she performs Chopin and Rachmaninoff cello recitals with longtime recital partner, pianist Inon Barnaton. Elisa Weilerstein, welcome to the Classical Classroom.
Thank you so much.
And what are you going to be teaching me about today?
You tell me.
I'm hoping that you'll teach me about Rachmaninoff, who I have been told is Rachmaninoff and not, as we say in Texas, Rachmaninoff.
No, it's not.
Well, let's get right to it. Who was this guy? When and where did he live?
Well, he was a Russian composer. Mm-hmm. Lived in the late 19th and early to mid 20th centuries. Mm-hmm. He's primarily known for his incredible output for the piano. You know, this things that one can hear in movies are his piano concerti. And he also wrote some fantastic orchestral works, such as the symphonic dances and the symphonies. I don't know if you've seen the movie Birdman, for example.
Oh, yeah.
When Michael Keaton starts flying through the air, the Rachmaninoff Second Symphony comes in, one of the most famous and beautiful sort of tear-jerking moments comes in. And this is just, it's an amazing, amazing moment.
Yeah.
And it's a great moment in the movie as well. I mean, the use of music in that movie is just, it's just mind-boggling to me. But that was one moment which I thought we should highlight since we're talking about Rachmaninoff today.
Yeah.
And Rachmaninoff was generally not known for writing chamber music. Mm-hmm. And certainly not for piano and strings. I mean, one can count probably on one hand the amount of works that he wrote for piano and strings. Mm-hmm. So we cellists feel very lucky that we have this incredible sonata for cello and piano, Opus 19, which I recorded with wonderful pianist and very good friend Inon Barnaton.
Who were Rachmaninoff's contemporaries? Who else was making music around this time that he may have been sort of influenced by? Was he part of a movement or anything like that?
Well, yeah, I mean, this was the early 20th century. So, yeah. I mean, with people who followed him or actually were, they were slightly younger, but they were alive at the same time, were actually Shostakovich and even, Prokofiev. But they took things, even Stravinsky as well. And of course, they took things in a very different direction. Rachmaninoff is very often thought of as a more kind of romantic composer. Mm-hmm. He sort of stuck with that romantic language, whereas the others took a very different path, Stravinsky, of course, wrote this groundbreaking Rite of Spring in 1920. Shostakovich, of course, really was he was born in 1906. Mm-hmm. Now, he was probably the strongest, most poignant voice of the Soviet Union at that time. But Rachmaninoff stuck with this kind of very lush, romantic, and very tonal language, even mm-hmm. though he lived until the mid-20th century. So the Sonata for Cello and Piano really, really reflects that that kind of language. Yeah. You know, and when I say he stuck with the Romantic language, I don't say this in any disparaging way. He stuck with it. Let's say an older language, but it was absolutely his own individual stamp on it. Right. There is no composer really that one can really compare him to. It was absolutely unique. And very imaginative and absolutely inspired. He's a truly great composer in every way, and I think that's indisputable.
Was he one of the composers who actually left Russia or the Soviet Union?
Yes,
he was. Yes. Okay, mm-hmm. So he was mm-hmm. sort of in mm-hmm. diaspora.
He left Russia. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. What made you want to pair his music with Chopin's?
Well, it's a piece, first of all, that we both absolutely adore, but. You know, Chopin has this in common with Rachmaninoff that he didn't write very much for instruments that were not the piano. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Chopin actually only wrote, I think, 3 works of chamber music. And he didn't write much of a sinfonica, but that wasn't actually a piano concerto. So, I mean, he was even more sort of specific than Rachmaninoff was. Of course, Rachmaninoff lived a much longer life. He died in, you know, 1943 and was born, I think, in the 1880s, if I'm not mistaken. I can't mm-hmm. remember exactly the date. But Chopin died at the age of 39.
That's right,
and one wonders, you know, the Chopin Sonata was the very last work published in Chopin's lifetime. And the cellist that premiered it, the sonata, was actually the pallbearer at Chopin's funeral.
Oh my gosh!
So you know, one wonders what he would have done, because the sonata was an incredibly successful piece in intellectually and compositionally and everything. Mm. Even though Chopin actually struggled writing it, but you know, it's indisputably a very, very successful piece. So you know, you just wonder what would have happened if he had had a chance to to fully develop that.
Yeah. You know. So basically, you've got music on the CD by 2 composers mm-hmm. that did not specialize in this instrument.
Right.
Yeah. Interesting. Well, I'd love to hear some of the music. Can we,
of course.
Can we just start at the beginning of the piece? And first of all, could you introduce the piece by Rachmaninoff?
Yes, of course. This is the Rachmaninoff Sonata for Cello and Piano in G Minor, Opus 19.
Okay.
And this is played by myself and Inon Banatan.
Okay.
Very, very kind of unusual and very special introduction that just happened.
Mm-hmm.
It kind of sets the tone for the sort of general mood of the first movement,
uh-huh.
and then of course the movement then begins to evolve from this point. I mean, I feel like that it truly begins actually where we just stopped.
Yeah.
That this beginning is sort of, you know, it's searching, it's pleading
mm-hmm.
in a way, and then the story begins here.
I see. Yeah, it's sort of a preface.
Yes,
to the story. Yeah. You know, I've heard some other music for cello mm-hmm. and piano.
Mm-hmm.
How is Rachmaninoff's different from, say, I think it was the Beethoven that I heard. How is his distinctive?
Well, I mean, how can I mean, how long do you have, really? I mean, the language, of course, is completely different. Yeah. But actually, Beethoven, it's interesting you mentioned it, because, I mean, if we're talking about sort of the roles of the cello and the piano in the Rachmaninoff, because Beethoven was the first composer to really write a sort of equal dialogue between the instruments. I mean, if you look at some of the, even the very early Beethoven sonatas, Beethoven wrote 5 sonatas for cello and piano. Mm-hmm. The first sonata is really, it's almost like it's a piano sonata with cello obbligato. Mm-hmm. The second sonata is a little bit less like that. By the time the third sonata comes along, it's truly an equal dialogue. So he really set the parameters for what was actually possible.
So I'm going and to extrapolate that obbligato means just like obligatory.
Oh, obbligato means that it's kind of like it's more important than an accompaniment, but it's sort of like it's a secondary role.
Right. Okay.
Know what I mean?
Gotcha, yeah.
It wasn't an equal partnership by any means. Mm-hmm. And of course, Mozart wrote, he didn't write anything for cello and piano, but he wrote for violin and piano, but he said, this is a sonata for piano with a violin accompaniment. Mm-hmm. So, and, you know, of course, now we kind of think the other way around. I mean, people sometimes make the mistake of saying, oh, you're playing the Rachmaninoff cello sonata. They say, no, this is a sonata for cello and piano. This is a truly a duo undertaking, and any romantic sonata is pretty much the same.
Really, that's a characteristic of romantic music.
Yeah, like both Brahms sonatas, the Franck sonata, anything else really.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Neat. Instruments are equal, but they often they're obviously different. And
Yes. Piano
was kind of Rachmaninoff's thing. How does he treat the two instruments differently? Is one more complex than the other? Is one like can you tell that piano is his specialty when you're playing the music? Is it How does he navigate that?
Yeah, so one can tell, of course. I mean, the way he writes, you can find a lot of the sort of similar patterns or similar style in some of the piano concerti, for example. Mm-hmm. But what is surprising is how naturally he writes for the cello. Mm-hmm. And so he, in the first movement, and this is what we're playing right now, I mean, the cello generally takes on a very sort of singing, sort of storyteller role, whereas the piano has, all of sort of the complex harmonic structures and can kind of expand upon these things. And he gives the piano a little bit more parameter to do that than he gives the cello.
I see.
It's in the third and fourth movements, though, I think he actually, he allows both instruments to be as free as possible, whereas the piano really has the complete freedom, I think, in the first movement and the second as well.
Well, yeah. Let's hear some of the third movement.
Yeah, third movement is my favorite, actually.
Really? Okay. This may be kind of a personal question, but what story do you think of when you're playing?
I don't think of a specific story here, actually. I mean, no, it's the music is too I think that's very personal for anyone listening to it. I wouldn't want to spoil their own kind of imagery. But actually, you know, I don't think of something specific. I mean, it's you know, the music says everything, and sort of, I mean, one reason that I think that what we do is important is it transcends the need for, let's say, narrative storytelling, because it tells a story of its own.
Yeah, yeah, and it allows people too to sort of superimpose their own stories onto it.
Sure, yeah. That's fair. Absolutely. Yeah.
Why this is your favorite movement? What is it about this movement that makes it different from the others?
Hard to say. It's a very emotional thing for me, this one, actually. His use of harmony and to guide the listener to this, this place of kind of ecstasy, I think, is something. And I think in some of his strongest writing, he's able to do that almost as no one else is able to do it. You know, that kind of tear-jerking quality, but yet without being sentimental in any way.
Mm-hmm.
And that, of course, it's very characteristic of his own playing of his music, for example. I mean, you know, it's very easy to kind of indulge Rachmaninoff with extra slides or extra this or that kind of superimpose one's own timings on it, but actually he writes everything that he wants in the score, and if you truly follow it and are connected emotionally and so that way you kind of marry the head and the heart, I think it speaks most directly. So and this movement, it gives you everything that way, I think.
Yeah. Man, that is just gorgeous.
Thank you.
He just makes no bones about, like, reaching right into your chest and just pulling on your heartstrings.
Absolutely. So, absolutely.
Just, like, yanking on
it. But in a very direct and honest way, without being saccharine. And that's what's so very special about Rachmaninoff.
That's his thing. That's, Well, in the time that we've got left, I was interested, too, in talking to you about your partnership with Ilan Barnaton.
Thank you.
Sure. How did you meet? I know that you've been playing together for a long time.
Yeah, we actually met in a very sort of boring and practical way. We have the same manager, Pat Winter, at Opus 3 Artists, and I've been with her almost 19 years. And in 2008, I was really desperately looking for a recital partner, and she said, well, you know, you really ought to play with Ilan, or at least read with him, see what you think. And I thought, you know, I love her very much, but I thought, well, what in the world does she know about musical partnerships? But it turned out she knew a lot, because from the very first note we played together, it was obvious there was a really sort of instantaneous kind of musical connection.
Mm-hmm.
He's also one of my best friends now, which is great. You know, when you're touring, it's nice to have somebody that you like touring with, you know?
Yeah.
It started, with a really kind of very similar approach to music making, similar sort of priorities, and a very deep understanding of each other and also of the music. And that allows for tremendous trust and freedom on stage. So that's it's allowed us to kind of really grow together and evolve together. So it's really nice.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking about that. I mean, and you're a soloist. You play with symphonies, and but I was wondering what that's like to have that kind of deep musical relationship with one other performer. Like, what does that allow you to do as a performer that you wouldn't be able to do on your own or with a larger group, with a quartet, for example?
As I said, I mean, it's really about trust and understanding. Mm-hmm. And so it's when we rehearse, we don't actually talk very much. It's mostly about playing. I mean, if something isn't quite working, we might discuss or, you know, try some different ideas out. But usually it's a very sort of natural thing. We do a lot of playing and kind of nonverbal communication. And so on stage, this makes for something. It's kind of an experience. It'd be like having dinner with a really, really great friend that you have a fantastic kind of, you know, verbal chemistry with. And, you know, you just can talk about anything and the conversation just flows. And it can, if you want to take it in a different direction, you can. And if not, then you don't have to. I mean, it's just, there's no pressure.
Yeah.
It also, I mean, it gives me or him freedom to try something completely different in the concert and to know that the other person's going to catch it.
Yeah.
Even if, you know, we haven't discussed it or something, nothing has to be really planned,
mm-hmm.
which is fantastic. And that's the best kind of chamber music making, I think.
Is there a favorite moment that you have on the CD that's really...
Oh, I don't think so.
Between the two of you, where you feel like your music... Where you're really...
No.
No, you got no...
I'm sorry.
That's okay.
it's very hard to pick one. I mean...
I could phrase that differently. I think that every musical partnership has a personality in the same way that an individual music performer has a personality.
Sure.
What would you say your dual personality is? Like when you play together, what is it sort of
that's
defines
difficult.
The two of you? I know, it's a big question. or we can listen to an example of that,
okay,
let's
listen to
an
example, sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what, is there a particular spot you'd like to listen to?
Let's start the last movement.
Okay, the last movement, okay. Mm-hmm. All right. You can hear how comfortable the two of you are playing together. There's no...
Building phrases together. Sometimes we have unison, sometimes there's interplay, and it's always a dialogue.
Yeah, there doesn't
seem... It's very open, yeah.
There doesn't seem to be a lot of separation. Like, I've heard people playing together
where
both players are very, very gifted, clearly, but there's not the same unity that there seems to be in your playing.
And that was there from the very beginning, and I think that was one reason why we thought, okay, we really need to, you know, pursue this, because that was something that we found very unusual. I mean, we didn't have to work for that.
Yeah.
For that kind of unity, and that was very, very special and important.
Alisa Weilerstein, thank you for coming on and teaching me about this lush, amazing music.
Thank you.
Really never heard much Rachmaninoff. This was very cool.
Oh, okay. Well, you've got to hear some more.
Right? Yeah, I think so.
Yeah, absolutely.
Awesome. All right, that about does it for this episode of Classical Classroom. For more Classroom, go to houstonpublicmedia.org/classroom. You can follow us on the Twitters, the Tumblrs, the YouTubes, and you can swear your allegiance to us by subscribing to us on iTunes and rating and reviewing us. I'd like it if someone would say, "It's better than Cats. I want to hear it again and again." You can also email me at dclay@houstonpublicmedia.org. Thanks today to audio producer Todd Tight Like a Tiger Hulslander for twiddling knobs. Thanks to program director Sinjin Flynn for being artificially created in a lab. Thanks to editor Mark DiClaudio for his piercing $1 million eyes. Thanks to Alisa Weilerstein for being here today. Thanks to me for saying words. But most of all, thanks to you for listening. We'll catch you next time.